Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hey everyone, so thanks for joining us today as always, and whether it's 10 years or 700 guests or somewhere around there. So today, our guest is Rose Szabo. She's here to talk to us about her very first novel, What Big Teeth, which was published in February by Faroe Strauss and Giroux. Rose has written some short stories about monsters, and has also started on a young adult duopoly, The River City, the first of which is called We All Fall Down. So What Big Teeth is called a novel about monsters and horror and werewolves and a yucky mer creature, magic, strange, violent group of people in a world populated by lots of unsavory images and visions. But as I read it, I really thought it was a book about a family. About a family that I almost kind of felt were a nice bunch of people. Sure, they had their issues, but no more than like a family in a Jonathan Franzen or John Updike novel. And it was pleasant reading about their interactions, their Jane Eyre and Wuthering Heights angst and confusion. And I don't really like books about werewolves and vampires and such, like Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. And either does Rose's grandmother, by the way. But What Big Teeth is so much better because we never hear the terms that are associated with zombie apocalypse stuff. And it makes things so much more real and regular, which is what creates the wonderful juxtaposition that makes this book so fascinating. So welcome, Rose, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. And my grandmother actually said something similar when she finally read the excerpt from chapter one. And she texted me to say, oh, I didn't realize that this was autobiographical. I will read it. So I'm very excited to hear what she thinks when she gets around to it.
I never ask that autobiographical question because it always sounds like Terry Gross. So I never ask it, but I'm glad you said it. So, oh, do you have a copy of the book there? So I just had a proof, so I didn't have a copy of the cover.
Oh, yes. This is the cover.
So when your grandmother saw that, didn't she get like, did she see that and go, this is, you know, whatever?
I don't know how she's reacted to the cover. She and I have a mostly texting relationship where she tells me about what books she's currently reading and I tell her what I'm reading. I don't think the cover would put her off, though, because she's always read mysteries, and mysteries just have some of the most lurid covers you've ever seen.
That's true. I kind of like them. I don't like the books, but I like the covers. Oh, yeah. And since I own a bookshop, and I'm always saying this, people are probably sick of it, but you know, you always see you can't judge a book by its cover, but everyone who comes into the bookstore judges the book by its cover. And so this is a really cool cover, and it's going to appeal to a certain kind of person. And what I want to do today is make sure they understand that it's not necessarily that. But publishers are really smart. So did you get to vet the cover, or did you pick it, or how did that work out?
I had a certain amount of back and forth about the cover. The artist, I really love all of their work. That's Corey Brickley. There were three versions of the cover, and Corey and I were actually really plugging very strongly for one where there's like a long strip of the cover that's been torn away to like show just a swirling mass of darkness and teeth. And the publisher liked this like much smaller little bit more. And I was amazed at how like strong my feelings were about that. But they asked me to trust them because they said that this cover would speak to the audience of like young adult readers who liked horror. And so far, the response to the cover has only been positive. Everybody who's seen it has just said, oh, it's so stunning. Oh, it took my breath away. Been exciting.
I would always trust publishers because they're trying to sell books. So I figure, you know, they know best, you know. But the other cover you described sounds a little like Grandma Persephone's last card, which I'm not going to do spoilers, but it sounds like that swirling mass thing. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So then, since I own a bookshop, I'm then interested in epigraphs, which presage a lot of the book. And you have two here. The first one would be expected, which was from Dracula. And I always think, you know, you must think about them a long time. The second one is the one that's fascinating because, as we were talking about before we started today, it's about, it's T.S. Eliot from The Wasteland, and it's about tarot cards, which figure prominently in the book. So did that come to you like before, or did you think about it during the book, knowing that you had such an interest in T.S. Eliot anyway?
I think that my original sense of how this book was related to T.S. Eliot was a different section from The Wasteland, Death by Drowning. It's one of the shorter sections, which is just a poem about a drowned sailor who's sort of floating on the bottom of the ocean. And I was really thinking about the relationship between that poem and one of the characters in the story who is in some ways like that drowned sailor, like no longer alive, but something else.
Yeah.
Something that is not alive. And so that was originally what I was thinking about. But then, you know, I returned to that section of The Wasteland that's about the tarot cards and really fell in love with the way that that sort of prefigures the rest of the poem and in some ways prefigures the book.
Yeah, it's like you were saying about T.S. Eliot. When we were doing The Tempest and I first heard "Those are pearls that were his eyes," that really got to me. Mm-hmm. Because it was like the first time I thought about, you know, a sea change, literally and figuratively. But Okay, enough for me rambling. We're trying to sell the book, so I figure we go deductively. So why don't you talk a little bit about, like, we'll talk about Eleanor, but talk about when she first sees the house, because the house itself is almost like a character in the book.
Yeah. So when she first returns home, there's this scene where Eleanor is reconfronting her family, and the first, I suppose, member of her family that she reconfronts is this house, which she describes as a giant squatting over the landscape. And she's been living in a boarding school, which has, you know, fairly close confines. There's not a lot of space to spread out. And in this very sort of confining life as well, with lots of rules and structures and harsh punishments for any deviance from the norm. And so suddenly encountering this big, wild house, even though it's something that she's longed for a long time and missed, fills her with this sense of dread. And I've been thinking a lot, you know, about how, you know, especially right now in quarantine, about how freedom and the freedom to do whatever you want can in some ways be this very terrifying thing. And the house represents some of that terror. It's the freedom of having a lot of wealth, of having a lot of land, of having very few restrictions on what you can and can't do.
It's funny. One of the things after the book is that you really realize, and I went back because you realize not how naive she was, but the feelings she had when she first saw the house versus the mandate she was given by her grandmother, and then how she took that to a certain certainty that I never would have expected. And so I guess with that, we don't have to talk about Sister Catherine or Lucy Spencer or anything like that, but we can talk about, why don't you talk about Eleanor and the original pickle she finds herself in, and then being on the train and kind of having, I liked when she had to jump off. I didn't think about them just slowing down, you know?
Yeah, so Eleanor leaves boarding school after spending 7 years there and after having all of her requests to come home and even some attempts at running away refused by her grandmother. But one day in the beginning of summer, when she's 17, she flees boarding school after a confrontation with another student and takes all of the money that she has and gets on a train. And that's, you know, where the story sort of begins, in this place where she's moving between the life that she's known and a life that she remembers as being better, but can't really put her finger on.
Yeah, it's funny.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, yeah, she can't put her finger on it. And then when she gets home, after being kind of jumping from the train a little too fast, when she gets home and she sees her mother, and at first I think her mother's going to be something, and then all of a sudden she's something different. And you do that all the time. And like with Grandpa Miklos, you know, you think he's going to greet her a certain way, and instead he greets her in this completely other way. And then he kind of like goes, oh, yeah, I've missed you, my beloved. So you do that with pretty much everybody, from Arthur to Grandmère to, well, Aunt Margaret's kind of the most stable and she's kind of like the weirdest. So, I mean, I could go on and on, but, you know, okay, you can go from her sister, from Grandma Persephone to Rhys to Arthur Knox to, there's so many cool characters and they're so well drawn. I can always tell when a book is good because I remember the names of the characters. So
thank you.
Where do these templates for these people come up? Because they're all so unique, or they are unique.
Yeah, I mean, I think I thought a lot about how in families, especially as you get older, people who you initially think of as being one way, and you have like a story about what kind of person they are and who they are to you and whether they're the hero or the villain in their relation to everybody else, how that can change really suddenly, particularly as you're passing from being a child to an adult. And so for a lot of those characters, I tried to think about like, what would the fearful version of Eleanor see in them and fear about them? And then who are they actually, or who are they to themselves or to one another? Grandpa Miklos is one of my favorites in that respect. I think of him as the one who is the least socialized. He's the character who is in some ways the most dangerous because he is the closest to his animal self. But in other ways, he's more unburdened than other people with like sort of the rules of civilization, and in some ways can be more more friendly and affectionate because of that. He's not caught up in like, what is he supposed to be doing? He's thinking only about what does he want and what does he feel? Yeah, and with a lot of the characters, I thought about ways that I saw particular members of my own family or other people's families. And then how did I think about them again when I came to look back at them? And both of those things are true. Like neither version of that is fake.
I know, it's so funny because when you said your grandmother said, oh, I didn't know it'd be autobiographical, I'm thinking, wow, you must have had a really weird ass family. But but apparently
they're very strange.
So do you all think that if Grandma Persephone, is she still around? I mean, whoever she's modeled after.
I feel like Grandma Persephone is a composite in some ways of various female relatives that I have. I come from a family where there's a lot of very strong women who have sort of had to figure out how to do things because no one was going to help them. And that kind of, that sense of holding everything together and having to constantly be attending to and managing everybody's needs is something that I grew up wondering, like, am I going to have to do that someday? And feeling wholly unqualified for that. And so I wanted to write a character who was like impeccable at that, to be sort of a foil to Eleanor, who feels that she, you know, couldn't possibly.
Yeah, but she does. I admire her for what she did. But the other thing is, Miklos is the only one who has like a Marvel Cinematic Universe origin story. And, you know, coming from a land where no one had any words and then ending up in New York. And that was fascinating. And then essentially co-opting an identity. And Eleanor being kind of like, I don't know, taken aback by that. So yeah, he kind of started everything too, right? I mean, if it wasn't for him, nobody would be there.
Yeah, absolutely. And he is very, very loosely based on my great-grandfather, who came from Hungary and settled in Pittsburgh when he was about 17 years old and lived in a boarding house with a bunch of adult men speaking no English. The earliest record that I found of him is just like, you know, his name and, you know, written under language Magyar. That's all from him.
That's cool. That's like my grandfather too, coming from Belarus, and they changed his name. Same thing. They changed his name at Ellis Island because the Yiddish name was too hard to pronounce. And if I said it to you, I'd have to essentially spit on you in order to say it properly. But yeah, that was a really fascinating part of it. And also the fact that Eleanor is essentially attacked repeatedly, but she's able to fend everybody off. And it's like funny, like your cat there or like a dog. Like, is it pronounced Reese, his name? Her
Reese,
brother? Yeah.
yes.
So like with Reese, if you confront him the same way, like you would a dog, like just slapping him across the nose, all of a sudden he cowers, even though he has this great strength and ability to do things. But if you just approach him the right way, it's almost as like he then begins to behave. Even like when Miklos is coming there and greeting, and his wife says, ah, no, just calm down. And then he just kind of drifts off into this fugue state. And that's why, like, that's what I was saying about what you do is you disregard for the moment, and which this is why it's such a cool book, is you disregard for a moment their actual, if you will, animal nature, and you realize this is what might happen if you went home or I went home, depending on who our relatives were, So I assume that was something that you were really searching for, because the reviews have discussed it at length, and I certainly felt that way as well.
Yeah, I mean, I was very much trying to capture the feeling of the way that family dynamics work. The original title of the book was just Family, as though there was nothing else to say about it. And the way that, it's different when you come back as an adult and you're trying to figure out how you fit into this group of people who now seem really different from you, even though they are, your whole origin and the makeup of who you are now. But also to what extent you have to now as an adult be responsible for steering the shape of your family, for thinking about, okay, well, who are we going to be next? And, Eleanor is this sort of third generation, or yeah, third generation removed from that immigrant experience. And she's very assimilated into a sort of, American and human culture and has a very different idea about what the family should be than Grandma Persephone might. And some of the conflict between that becomes apparent really early in the book, where she's come home and she's questioning how they do everything and has no patience for the family's many eccentricities.
There's a lot of things I could ask about, but they're kind of spoilers, and I don't want to do that. But there's a lot of pivotal points in the book. Oh, I guess the pivotal character in the book is Arthur Knox. So why don't, as much as you want to, why don't you describe how he fits in, how he's different, and how the family kind of pivots around him because of their interest in him?
Sure. So Arthur is this figure who Eleanor meets when she comes home, and she had forgotten about him completely, but remembers when she does meet him that he once taught her how to play the piano. He's the family's longtime friend. He comes over for dinner often. He helps Grandma Persephone do her taxes. You learn that he's painted several of the portraits in the hall, although no one ever talks about it. And he is the family's obsession. Many members of the family have unrequited crushes on him, are obsessed with appealing to him and want to go everywhere that he's going and want to, want him to like them, but don't seem to have any interest in who he is or what he wants, except for Eleanor. Eleanor starts to ask him questions about, how did you meet my father? How long have you been coming to this house? What is your relationship to us? Questions that everyone else is sort of discouraging her from asking. He's sort of the center of the family's long-held secrets in some ways.
The interesting thing about Eleanor is, like I was saying, you don't see, maybe you don't agree with me, but the way she asks her questions is so straightforward. At first you think, and even the reviews will say she's hesitant, and one review said, I wish she had been more forthcoming, but I thought she was very forthcoming. And it's funny how when she asks her questions straight out, there's usually someone who gives her a dirty look. And that again gives you an idea of what might happen. No, it doesn't. It gives you an idea that something's going to happen, but you don't know what it is because they all are reluctant for her like when Aunt Margaret calls, uses that one word, says traitor, you know, it's like, and then you start to think, well, I wonder why they would think that when they're so weird ass, they're such weird ass people. How could anybody be weirder than that?
Right. Because she's questioning the way that they have always done things and the sort of unspoken agreements that the family has made with one another over the years. And I think that that's a common dynamic, like a particular member of a family becomes sort of an identified patient in some ways because they are the person who cannot stand the current system and has to ask questions about it. Regardless of how cautiously or diplomatically those questions get asked, that person, you know, is suddenly disrupting how everything has always been done. And I think Eleanor finds herself in that position of, because of her fear of the family's physical monstrousness, she has all these questions and concerns. But those questions and concerns point her toward, I suppose, the family's more, I think of as the family's, sorry about this, the family's more actually, toward her family's more actually monstrous traits, the things that they've done that are actually, you know, evil and worth commenting on and worth changing.
Yeah, it's
I'm
going to
put him outside. That's what he wants.
No, it's cute. It's nice. My dog comes up here. He has better questions than I do anyway. And then each of the character too seems at first, and then, well, they all seem to have a certain agenda that don't necessarily coincide with one another, whether it's her sister or Reese or Grandmere, again, without saying anything. And even, like, for example, even Charlie, who's this little boy in the beginning, in the first scene, essentially, and then morphs into something else. And again, as a reader, that's kind of a question, because it's not that you're left in the dark. It's that you're like in a dark room that has a switch that's a dimmer, and the dimmer just starts going up higher and higher. You know what I mean?
Wow, that's a great compliment. Yeah, I mean, I wanted to retain this feeling of mystery, and I also didn't want to give any family member, no family member is sort of part of like the family agenda. They don't have a clear, they don't have like a plan or like a supervillain goal. They're just a pre-existing ecosystem that's now been disrupted. And I always tried to think about when I was writing, not thinking about plot as much as about group dynamics and what people are teaming up on a particular issue because it matters to them, which two people are having a fight because their personalities clash in this particular way. And most of the conflict in the book, I think there's like conflict is introduced from that, from an outside character. And I'll also try not to make spoilers, but that just so much of the conflict and the rising action of the book is about those existing connections and rivalries and the ways that those escalate.
Yeah. And the difference between, say, the, you know, the corrections or one of, I don't know, even like Portnoy's complaint or something like that, is that there's a lot of blood involved, which there isn't in most of these books, even different kinds of blood.
Right. Yeah. They settle arguments in much the way that, like, you know, a pack of wild dogs would. They fight it out and then they retreat to their separate corners and then they come back and everything's okay. And that works for them, but it doesn't work as soon as they have anyone in their family who can't live by the wild dog rules and they don't know quite how to like accommodate someone who can't.
Yeah, it's like watching some show on Animal Planet where like two lions are fighting each other and it looks like they're killing each other and they just kind of separate and they're fine. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah, it looks to you like when Miklos runs up the stairs and she's ready to get, and he just nips her by the ankle. And I was thinking, oh my God, this is it. And she's thinking this is it too. She's always thinking, I'm going to be murdered. I'm going to be murdered. And then she's not, and something happens. But yeah, you know, in a lot of ways, it's like a book you'll never read another book like it. And I don't mean it like really as a compliment. It's just that as you read it, as I said in the beginning, there's this juxtaposition of things, and that's what pricks the reader's ears up. And without me blabbing away, the other thing about it is when that happens, you're making the reader think. And it's not like some books where you're just led along and at the end is just like, okay, we're done. So you must have thought about that too. You know, I want the reader to not know, you did. I want the reader not to know what's going on. And even at the end, I want the reader to think, oh, now what do I do? You know what I mean? That kind of feeling?
Yeah. I didn't want to produce a book with a clear message or an easy lesson. I kind of wanted, this was very much an experiment, I suppose. And I think, yeah, I think the it's been so long since it was a mystery to me, because, you know, I've worked on so many drafts of it, but that when I first sat down to write it, I kept being shocked. I kept being like, is that really what's behind that door? I didn't know. And that was really delightful to sort of have all of these twists and turns in the draft.
Yeah. So, okay. This is your first book, your first novel, and it's been very well received, but how long has it taken you to get to this point? Because if you're talking about all these different drafts and stuff.
I think I probably wrote the first serious draft of this book in 2014. I just moved back from Maine. I was living in a room that was basically like a laundry room. It had like a washer and dryer in it. And then my bed was in the corner and I was not particularly employed. And so I was like, okay, well, I have all of this free time on my hands. I have nowhere to go and no money to go there with. I'm going to finally write this book that I've been sort of thinking about for years, because I'd done a series of illustrations of the characters, but then hadn't known what their story was or what their interactions were going to be. And so I just sat down and wrote the draft as quickly as I possibly could so that I didn't have any time or any excuses to procrastinate. But that was, you know, about 7 years ago now. And so there was a lot of back and forth. I emailed the agent who I have now, basically right after I finished that terrible first draft, and showed her a slightly better version than that, which she very politely rejected and said, please send me your next book though, because that was really interesting. And so then I worked on this for another 3 years and went to an MFA program and did a really intensive novel workshop with this book and sent it back to her. And I was like, this is the next book, by which I mean it's the same book. Please read it again. And she did. And then she and I, you know, went around and around in a series of drafts. Yeah, I mean, I think it's gotten better every time, but it was definitely a harrowing process. And like, there's a lot of stuff on the cutting room floor.
That's what I was going to ask you, whether it got slimmed down or not, whether you had to take a lot out. Isn't that a hard process?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's often how it sort of goes. Like, I always want to put in everything. I always want to make like a very maximalist book. And so this, I mean, I realize that this is still a somewhat maximalist book, but a lot of things got pulled out. Grandma Persephone was originally a second point of view character for like the majority of the book. And that's gone. There are just a lot more characters who only get, you know, a little bit of screen time in this, who originally I was thinking about, okay, so how are they going to get woven in? So yeah, it's slimmed down significantly.
Well, it's funny though, because I could see an editor saying, what's Father Thomas doing in there anyway? And why are all these people coming up to this funeral? But then you realize Father Thomas, you know, he plays a fairly large part. Well, I don't want to get into that, but yeah. And then, you know, you do certain things like at this particular funeral, the weather, and weather is important in the book too. And, you know, the weather becomes, everything's like muddy and slickers. And you can almost see what that must have been like, especially like, you know, like the funerals I've been where everyone takes a little shovel of dirt. And here they had to pick up clods of mud and just throw them on top of the coffin. You know, it's it's like the flowers, Dracondia. Is there really such a flower? Mm-hmm. I didn't look it up. I should have.
Yeah, there is such a flower. It's like purple and almost black. It's very ominous looking. It looks kind of like an orchid.
And is it like, you know, grandma saying how it could be a love potion or it could be poison? Because when she said that, it obviously, the metaphor was that's what Eleanor could be too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think in a larger way, that's what family can be. Family can either make your life richer and more full of meaning and, you know, bring you this almost boundless joy, or it can be the thing that kills you, you know, over years. And I think that it's very much about how do you choose to use it? How do you let it work upon you?
When you said you did illustrations, did you mean like illustrations, or just little thumbnail sketches of what the characters would be like? You didn't draw pictures of them, did you? Or did you?
I did. So I found a picture frame in my parents' basement that had no pictures in it. It was one of those big ones that's meant for having like a lot of little portraits set into it.
Oh, so cool.
And I was sort of annoyed because my family is pretty bad at record keeping. We have like a lot of family stories that are basically urban legends, and that's about it. And so I was like, oh, this is so typical, but here's this like family portrait frame and there's nobody in it. And so I started drawing these little characters to sort of fill it in and going like, ah, yes, this is Cousin Gregory. And Cousin Gregory was, you know, just a dog. And then it sort of went from there.
Yeah, that's the one thing. You know, first when I read the review that compared it to the Addams Family, I just kind of sloughed it off. But then I thought about it, and I really like Gomez, and I really like Morticia, and I really like Lurch and Wednesday and Pugsley, you know? And and you can see in your mind, especially, I forgot who the artist was who did the cartoon. What was his name?
Charles Addams.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see you doing exactly what he did, you know, like drawing it out and saying, here's the characters. Because Gomez, yeah. Yeah, I mean, he was a nice guy. He was cool. He had a little ticker tape reader and Morticia in that dress and in the greenhouse, too. But at the same time, they did have the capability of, you know, imprisoning the postman or killing somebody inadvertently. But it was all funny. Oh, yeah, that's the other thing. There's a certain sense of humor throughout this. Sometimes it's like a very thin thread, but there's always a certain sense of humor. Do you agree, or am I wrong?
No, no, I agree. And I think I was very influenced by Charles Addams and also by Edward Gorey at a very early age. This idea that something can be, you know, grim and murderous and also, you know, really funny. And I think I definitely took from the Addams Family that idea of the huge sort of sprawling wealthy family with not much to do with their time. And also that idea that there's this sort of, from their perspective, they're totally harmless. That if and when they hurt somebody, it is not their intention. It is completely by accident. And yet that doesn't make them any less dangerous, even if it makes them more likable.
I have to realize, I bought this today on Amazon. I go on Amazon and I buy these totally random things and my daughters get really mad at me. But I bought this bath mat and it's two bloody hands just pushed down into the bath mat and has drips of blood going down it. And my girlfriend's going to kill me, but I couldn't resist. It's kind of like this.
Oh, I love that.
I could send you one. It would be perfect. Yeah, it's like, you know, like, yeah, it's like Lurch going out to the fence in front and sharpening the points on the spike with a file. It's those kinds of things that really get to you. Well, anyway, so as I was saying, and then I guess in conclusion, the books, you know, we're out of COVID, essentially, our bookstore now. So we're open, you know, 5 days a week with shorter hours. And there's never more than 10 people in a bookstore anyway. But everyone wears masks, obviously. But yeah, so your book's on the front and it's in the window. And
oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah. And so if we ever come out of this, and maybe when it comes out in paperback, you can come and visit us and hang out and do a signing or something like that.
Oh, I would love to. I've had so few opportunities to actually, you know, go out and read in public. And that's the stuff I'm really looking forward to, getting to actually, you know, be a part of this literary community at last.
Yeah. Lately, I've been thinking I'm really cool because I'm getting such great authors. But then I realized the only reason they're doing it is because they can't go out on tour. But it makes me feel like, oh, I'm a big shot now.
Okay. That's actually how I got my my audiobook reader. I asked for if Jessica Nicole, who, you know, is fairly famous, would be available to do it. And they were initially like, we don't think so. But, you know, COVID made it kind of hard for actors to work outside the home. And so, you know, I ended up with this like absolutely amazing reader. I mean, she also says she likes the book, and that's very flattering. But
it's a lot of voices to do.
Mm-hmm.
That's hard.
Absolutely. And she handles it beautifully. And she has a perfect Eleanor voice.
Oh, I got to get it. Okay, I'll do it. All right. Well, thanks again. It was a pleasure talking to you. It's a great book.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Okay, Rose. Bye-bye.
Bye.